This is the Freshman 15.
My name's Jeremy Bear, and I feel like there's enough room for both of us on this piece of driftwood. If you would just move over just a little bit, we could both survive. We could make it.
My name's Daniel Long, and I see you, I feel you, and I know that you will go on.
That's the worst thing our audience has ever heard. You nailed it, Celine.
Yes!
This is like the old days,
I
Daniel.
Know.
Two episodes in 1 month.
Oh, I love it.
We'll fess up. We did a little switcheroo, which was super fun. The fellas from the Hold Up podcast, John Nelson and John Longino, we agreed to swap podcasts, which was super fun.
I loved it so much.
Yeah. We did an episode, and which if you haven't heard, hi, you hints, over to the Hold Up podcast, which you can find at holduppodcast.com and listen to the Crocodile Dundee episode.
Oh, yeah.
Which you can listen to Daniel and myself doing our best Hold Up impression. And we're not going to reveal the answer, but you'll have to go over there to find out whether or not Daniel and I decide that Crocodile Dundee still holds up.
But I just love the kind of the creative aspect of saying, okay, we're going to talk about this film, what we thought maybe we felt about it, what we kind of idea of what it's going to be, and then we're going to watch it together, and then we're going to talk about it afterward.
Yeah, and that's, of course, the recipe of the podcast. And if you're not currently a listener of The Hold Up, once again, John Nelson and John Longino, such a great idea for a podcast. They've got great chemistry. It's a great podcast hour. But you know what I'm actually even more grateful for is the fact that they took on the task of doing a full Freshman 15 episode.
Totally legit. They did it all.
Yeah, it was great. So anyways, guys, John and John, thanks so much. You did such a great episode. I loved listening to it. The only requisite, by the way, was do an episode that we weren't already planning on doing. And, you know, they threw Rob Zombie out there.
And I was like, I can't believe they did that.
and when we confirmed, no, it's true. We were not probably going to do a Rob Zombie episode, but it was great.
It was so great. Robert Cummings. I mean, who knew?
We are aware that the episode was kicked off with an apology for crapping on Clerks.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say that we apologize for that apology.
Yeah, absolutely. It's still shit.
Well, Daniel, I don't know. You want to get into it?
Let's do it.
All right.
The Army has an experimental strain of fish that they've been
fish! Using. You see what's on the back of this? Blood. I found the nurse at the morgue with a throat torn out on dry land. I got another girl laying right next to her in the same condition. This is my conclusion. I got three bodies on my hands, and my wife is the last one to see. Two of them alive. There's nothing left to talk about. Stay the hell out of this. I don't want to hear any more of your cockamamie ideas. I want you to go home and sit on your hands. And the next time, lock your door.
So, you know, as far back as our earliest episodes, we've been taking suggestions about different directors and whatnot. And lest you think that we already know the directors that we want to do and who we like and who we want to cover in these episodes, genuinely, these suggestions, they make a difference.
I mean, you're right. I mean, two episodes ago, Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, following. A lot of times, if we're trying to debate between two directors that we might want to talk about or feature on this podcast, we'll always go with the one that we feel like we've been requested to do the most.
It's true.
So way, way back, and this is just like even just a few episodes into our first season, people started requesting a James Cameron episode. And every time James Cameron's name came up, I feel like maybe it was more me than you. I think it was more you. You were probably more willing to do it.
Uh-huh.
But I would always kind of like give you the look like,
I can't do it right now.
But you know what? We've been just sort of basking in the glow of these really, really great freshman films this whole season, right?
And we're going to continue that tonight.
If you're not already aware, the freshman film of legendary big budget, and when I say big budget, I mean the biggest budget director there is ever. His humble start was with a little film called Piranha Part 2, The Spawning.
I think we can go here right away. This film has multiple names.
Yeah, that's right. Because right? It was released, I think in Europe it was called Flying Killers, something yes. like that.
So Piranha 2, The Spawning, or Piranha 2, Flying Killers.
Flying Killers.
Piranha 2, The Number, the Roman numerals.
Yeah, sometimes Part 2, sometimes without the part and all that. And which I know, like you're probably saying, well, who cares? But when you're marketing a film, there should be some kind of consistency to your marketing plan.
So the fact that it's a sequel to something obviously yeah. means there was a first Piranha.
There was a first Piranha. There's a few things that I want to get out of the way.
Just right away.
Piranha 2, The Spawning, is a piece of shit.
Okay.
It's a terrible movie. And I'm sorry, I know we usually save these kinds of judgments till the end and,
no.
and it kind of comes out in the conversation. It is a terrible movie.
It's true. And sometimes I think it's easy to save judgments to the end because you're not sure how to judge the movie until the end.
Right.
But this kind of just goes right away.
First shot.
First freaking shot. The setup is about two people underwater trying to have sex.
They're almost trying to like tease what they're really talking about, which is like, do you want to do it? I don't know. Should we do it? Maybe we should do it. And it's this weird kind of back and forth. And you're like, I guess they're talking about screwing each other.
I mean, so.
Is that it?
What's the matter, honey? Is it me?
Oh, of course it isn't. I don't know. In the boat like this, it's uncomfortable.
Okay, the boat's uncomfortable. The beach was too sandy. The air in the room was too conditioned.
Oh, I bet it's the water in the hotel. They should let you know you can't drink it. Hang up a sign or something.
You're trying too hard. That's all.
Yeah, I need to relax more.
We can relax more later. Now let's do what we came out here for.
And you find out the thing that they're talking about really wanting to do is to deep sea dive down to some sunken boat and not just take their clothes off, but using a Crocodile Dundee knife,
I know.
Slice each other's clothes
Call
off.
Callback. I was thinking about that. It's like, wow, this is a knife, right? I mean, it's like, here it is.
Yeah, in one of the most disturbing shots I've seen in recent memory, a Mick Dundee enormous, what, army blade or something like that, slice off some dude's Speedo.
Oh, yeah.
Which I don't know why that's easier than just taking the thing off, but
yeah.
I don't know, whatever. It's clearly a very sexy encounter, which is interrupted by piranhas.
Right, which begs so many questions. One is, don't you need air underwater?
Well, that was the thing, too. They started just removing their masks and all their
and they started kissing underwater?
And all their breathing apparatus.
I mean, it's impressive, but confusing.
You know what? We're getting way too deep, way too soon. Let's go back up to the surface for just a minute here.
Oh, nice.
Piranha 2, The Spawning, freshman film of James Cameron. 1981 film. So James Cameron, at the time, of course, he was, he was a writer, and he was also, I think he was hired originally on that film, mostly as like an effects guy.
Oh, is that, okay, so I know he was hired by Roger Corman as an effects guy, so he was also hired on Piranha 2, is that originally?
Well, here's the thing, and this is what I noticed, because apparently this is like a rabbit hole that just gets deeper and deeper. It's not easy to find two accounts of the Piranha Part 2, The Spawning story that agree.
Yes. Thank you for bringing this up.
About like how much was James Cameron involved? Was he the director from the beginning? Was he brought in later? And if so, was he fired early? How many directors
right.
did it have? It's all sort of this. There seem to be all these varying accounts about the real story about how this movie was actually made. What is clear, though, is that there was some sort of contentious situation.
Yeah.
The official credited director is James Cameron. Now, I've heard, or at least I've read, that even James Cameron doesn't consider this his freshman film. He considers his freshman film The Terminator.
Of course. Why wouldn't you?
Well, sure.
Yeah, I heard this story as well, that he was contractually obligated to have his name as director on the film, which I don't know why that would be a contract obligation.
Yeah, see, this is where it all gets very strange, because the producer had hired a director.
Mm-hmm.
There were some sort of creative differences. James Cameron was, it appears that he co-wrote the screenplay.
Right.
And I don't know if this was after the shooting had already begun. Maybe he was doing script edits. It's so hard to figure out what the deal was. But whatever the case, he took over the film.
Yep.
I don't know if he completed shooting or not before the producer took it back over. And maybe I read another story where he wasn't even allowed in the editing room.
Yeah.
And there's all these just strange conflicting things when you see it, the idea of conflicting creative visions is what produced yeah, this. Totally. What creative vision to begin with, like, led to just such a terrible film?
Absolutely. So I think it's safe to say that why there probably are so many conflicting stories is because nobody wants sole credit or blame for this movie, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's got to be the reason.
Well, so here's the thing, and this is where I decided that I was going to land. I personally choose to believe that, yes, this is truly James Cameron's freshman film. Mm-hmm. The biggest reason that I have for believing that is because I think at its core, it genuinely is a James Cameron film.
Man, can you believe the threads in this movie? Mm-hmm. And of course, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. So before we probably go into what are some of the common threads in James Cameron films, we need to really give a premise of this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to go for it?
You want me to do it?
Oh, we'll probably tag team this
okay,
one.
Okay, sure. So Piranha 2... First of all, lest you think that this has anything to do with the first Piranha movie, which, by the way, Daniel, I'll come clean. I have not seen the first Piranha movie. I don't know if you've seen
it. I actually have not seen it.
Okay. Which was another freshman film, Joe Dante. Great director.
Yeah. Gremlins.
Gremlins, that's right. The Burbs, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. The idea here was, of course, just like any sequel, certainly as any cheesy sequel is going to do, they take the premise of the first movie and they figure out some way to up the stakes.
Yeah.
In this case, the idea of just killer piranhas haunting some, I don't know, lagoon or resort or something like that. By the way, everything is just such a blatant Jaws ripoff.
Oh my goodness. With the beginning, yeah. Right with the opener.
Right off the bat, just naked people and, you know, all the way over to, but, you know, we've got to clear the beach. No, it's tourist season. We can't, I mean, just every beat for beat, they're trying to be Jaws. There's this little sort of resort. You come to find out later, there's been a military experiment awry. And
where eggs have been dropped.
Eggs have been dropped on this, in this really specific part of the, I don't know, this inlet or this, you know, this, well, maybe it's just the ocean. And what's been spawned are these killer flying piranhas.
Emphasis on the freaking flying.
On the flying. But here's the thing that I find amazing, though. These piranhas, they start to terrorize the people that are not just in the water, but later on, just even out of the water in town, just because, of course, they can fly. But the thing that's so amazing is everyone is so, like, majoring on this idea that, oh my God, these piranhas have wings.
Yeah.
But no one really is even thinking about the fact that kind of crazy that they're able to just breathe air also.
I know. You know. I know. It's super crazy. And you even have like that moment of exposition where you have the person who works for the government. I can't even remember his name, but he says something like the flying fish.
Four canisters of fertile piranha eggs sank right there. Three were found. We spliced in genes from different species to create the ultimate killer organism. Grunions who could live out of water. Dactylopteridae, the common flying fish you see in the bay here, so it could live in all environments. You understand?
My God. We've got to tell somebody right now, and you have got to come with me to convince them.
It's the pseudoscience. It's the whole thing that you see in all these terrible movies. But of course, so what happens is, you know, we're following the story of a woman and her son, who almost seems to be her lover at first.
Okay, we need to talk about the son. Are we going to get into this? Because honestly, are we going to wait?
Look, it's all going to come out eventually, but whatever the case, this woman and her, we don't really know if it's a estranged husband or ex-husband, but whatever. And they have a son together, and the husband is kind of like beach patrol or something, and they're all embroiled in these piranha murders in one way or another. And of course, it's all this big
piranha
quest.
Murders. It's true, though. That's exactly what they are.
You know, needless to say, it ends with a it ends with explosions both under and over the sea.
Oh yeah,
that somehow wipe out these piranhas. You assume.
Oh yeah, for sure, and lots of neck deaths, right? I mean,
neck attack.
That's where the piranhas go.
Yeah,
they go for the neck.
The piranhas go right for the neck.
That's how they know they're going to get them. Honestly, we need to start with this. With what's going on between the son and Anne? Is that her name?
Yes, Anne Kimbrough.
Okay, so it begins with this young boy who's going into this room, this hotel room, where this woman is sleeping.
Naked.
Naked. James Cameron wants us to know that possibly something's going to happen here, yeah. right? I mean, you see a thigh and the sheets over her body, and she's sleeping, and then you see this young boy waking up at this woman, right?
Yeah, in a flirty way.
I did not know that this was going to turn out to be her son.
No.
There's nothing that tells you that.
In fact, the scene extends into breakfast until finally she says, oh, well, you know, something about, you know, I'd kill you if you weren't my son or something like that. You're like, whoa.
Wait a minute.
Hold on. There's been a whole lot of, like, not just flirting, but just almost just kind of like
sexual tension.
Yeah.
And then it keeps going. Even after you realize this is a mother and son situation.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like touching noses.
It still gets weird. Right? Does it feel weird to you even after?
The whole thing is weird. I mean, I think part of it is, and I don't know if this is James Cameron, or I don't know who this is coming from. I don't know if this is like a studio or a producer mandate or something. But there's this insistence on this sexual undercurrent to almost every scene.
Every scene.
A lot of toplessness throughout the whole thing. And by the way, I don't know if you were someone who's considering going to see Piranha 2, The Spawning. You're going to see a lot of boobs.
There's some boobs in there.
All through. And, you know, if that's what you're looking for, then, well, quite frankly, there's probably better movies. But it's just...
Are you talking about for boobs?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of better... There's much better movies for boobs out there, but yeah, whatever. You don't need it. And I hate to say something that sounds so prudish, is it's just gratuitous, but it's really the only thing this movie is.
It's all over, and it's not even just in terms of the flesh. I mean, it's like violence and...
The jokes are even like...
Oh my gosh, it's just the jokes.
Horrible. There was just this brand of just kind of dumb humor that they thought, well, it's a cheap movie. We have to have just sort of bad jokes and stock characters and... And I remember from movies from this era, women who were way oversexed, and, you know, it just seems like in every scene, there's a man trying to resist some woman that just wants to get laid so bad.
Right.
That's the driving force behind all these relationships, if you want to call
them
that.
And in Piranha 2, right, one of those women is an older woman.
Older woman, sure.
Going after the younger man.
Say, Ronnie, you wouldn't care for a casual encounter, no complications. I could show you a thing or two that would put these young girls to shame.
I bet you could.
You know what the doctor said killed my last husband?
No, ma'am.
Excitement.
Going back to what you said about stock characters, this is one of the more offensive movies I've seen recently. In terms of stock characters.
Yeah.
The first 25, possibly 30 minutes is just introducing you to every freaking person.
Yeah.
On this, wherever they are.
And I was wondering, are they trying to get me to like these people so that it's hard for me when they get killed by piranhas later?
I don't know.
If so, it wasn't really working because...
There were so many.
It wasn't even like I disliked them so much that I was excited to see them killed by piranhas. I was just like, I just kind of want them to go away. Everyone was so hard to watch.
They were all
every line, every joke was such a cringe.
Yeah.
It was hard to take in.
Okay, so you have this boy who's the son of this dynamite fisher, and I'm not actually sure what's wrong with him.
Like he had some kind of handicap maybe.
But how he's portrayed seems really offensive to me. He never speaks that I remember. I don't know if he's mute or what's going on there.
Yeah.
But the way he's portrayed is extremely confusing for a viewer. I can't think of it any other way than that I'm supposed to laugh at this character.
Yeah.
You have another character later on, right? Who's this chef who has a stutter, I think.
Yeah. He's like the spectrum-y guy.
He tries to stutter at least. It's just overwrought.
And the poor guy, all he wants is a threesome. I mean, it's not complicated.
That's all he wants.
Can't you spare a threesome for this poor guy with a mental handicap?
But it's so cringeworthy.
Yeah.
He's stuttering. he comes to the boat with the food that he says he's going to bring him.
To have a threesome with these two ladies that look 20 but sound like they're 50.
Yeah, it's good. That's true.
It's maybe the worst ADR I've ever heard in a movie in my life. And by the way, ADR, it's voice dubbing that's done later. And a lot of times it's done because maybe there was bad sound conditions or something on the day. And so they bring the actors in later to re-record their voice and they dub them in. And especially with some of these older movies, you can tell like, okay, now that doesn't sound like someone speaking on a beach. That sounds like that was recorded in a studio or something. You're like, ah. But usually they try and at least attempt to get the same actresses.
Yeah, why wouldn't they?
But it's so clear that they have these middle-aged women doing the ADR for like these young, hot, topless ladies. It's a recipe that just sort of winds up as this really disturbing dish. I don't know how else to put it.
It's a disturbing dish.
It's a disturbing dish all around.
What's your name?
Mel.
Mel. Look, Mel, why don't you come by the boat later on? We'll have a nice dinner. We'll cruise around the bay for a while. Maybe get a little stoned. Know what I mean? I'm sure that Loretta and I can keep you entertained.
this is dinner?
Yeah, that's dinner.
I don't know.
Listen, Loretta's hip. She trusts my judgment in men. Mel, have you ever made it with two girls?
It feels like this whole thing was put together without any sense of the overall idea or picture.
It was just cheaply done. I mean, money was clearly spent on this thing.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, it's still a James Cameron film, so there's thought that goes into some of these effects and whatnot, even though, you know, even the effects were terrible. But you think, like, if you're going to go to the lengths of building fake piranha and finding these, like, I want to say, like, half of it was shot in Rome and, you know, half of it was shot in, like, Grand Cayman or something. You've got budget. You're going to these terrific lengths. I don't know. It just seems like such a shame that you're cheaping out on such a terrible script, which James Cameron co-wrote, by the way.
Okay, yeah. He can't get off the hook with that.
Yeah.
It is a terrible script.
I mean, honestly, we could spend our whole podcast hour just picking apart every horrible and cheap device and aspect of this movie. I mean, you know,
which sounds kind of fun, right? I mean, it sounds like a lot of fun. But yeah, we need to go somewhere.
It's so bad. And here's the thing. We've bashed on movies before. We certainly bashed on American Beauty. Mm-hmm. We bashed on Clerks, good Lord. Some snide remarks about THX. We certainly didn't have a lot of positive things to say about Fear and Desire. But I think each one of these movies are bad for different reasons.
Yeah.
And I feel like with Piranha 2, we've got an all new reason to not really like this movie. And this is one that I think that we haven't had yet before, which is all these other movies at least felt like they were trying.
Yes.
Clearly, terrific effort goes into completing a film, and that can't be overstated. It's true. The worst movie you've ever seen is a miracle of terrific effort. So I want to say that right off the
bat. That's a good point.
On the other hand, though, this movie, it's so thoughtless. I mean, you know intellectually that a lot of effort went into making this movie. It just doesn't feel like that. It feels like such an afterthought that no one gave a damn about other than, well, you know what? We've come this far. We may as well just finish this.
That's how it feels. I mean, it feels like, okay, here's what we have. We have piranhas. I mean, 81, that was even before I was born. But I do remember watching movies when I was little where piranhas were a thing.
Yeah.
So you have piranhas. You have nudity. I mean, I guess that's all you need, right? As I think about it, like...
Piranhas and nudity.
So that seems like the selling point for this movie. Everything else they could care less about. What is the next thing we need to do to either show a piranha or show naked women?
Yeah.
There's this recipe, there's this formula. If we just show these things, people are going to watch it.
Yeah, and there's sort of like a patronizing quality to that. I know this is like an over-analysis of the intent behind Piranha 2. It feels like we're thinking about it more than they ever did.
Yeah.
I don't know. I picture this guy in a boardroom with a big fat cigar going, people are idiots.
Yeah.
We flash some tits up there. We get, what was that? The one that came out that Spielberg kid did Jaws. Oh my God. Jaws was incredible. Yeah. Do a little of that. Big shark, too expensive. Yeah. Let's make it a bunch of little sharks or something like that. Can we make this thing for $500,000? Let's do it. And there it is. And it's greenlit and it's on. And it's such patronizing bullshit. I mean, we know it's film. Yes, it's art, clearly, and effort and craft went into it. And by the way, I don't want this to be unsaid. I mean, this is hard for me to say. I don't want to come across like there's nothing about this film that works at all. There are things that are not terrible, but there's so few of them and they're so far apart.
See, what people don't see is what I see, which is the pain in your face.
It's a Clerk's pain.
Like, okay, I have to say, there are things in here that work.
Every so often, and this is true, there would be an editing choice that I thought, oh, that was a nice edit.
That was a nice edit.
They could have drawn that edit out. They tightened it up. That was a nice edit. Every so often, Lance Hendrickson would deliver a line. I'll be like, you know what? That was a shitty line, but he delivered it well.
Right.
And I'm not saying he's the actor's actor by any stretch. Guy's a decent actor, though.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so you would get these moments and you cling to them like like buoys out in the middle of piranha-infested waters.
I mean, you have to. If that's all you have, you have to cling to them.
That's it. That's the only thing that, I mean, holy cow, Daniel, I watched it twice.
Yeah,
because that's
me too.
You did?
Yes.
You hadn't seen it before, right?
Oh, no, I'd never seen Piranha 2.
This movie was never designed to be watched twice.
Never.
It's James Cameron's first movie, though. Mm-hmm. And you already alluded to it earlier, but there are things in Piranha 2 that we see throughout the rest of James Cameron's career.
It's actually pretty remarkable. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think is pretty consistent in James Cameron movies is that he often cuts movies in half.
Hmm.
You even see that with Piranha. I mean, you have the opening section of this film where you see piranhas, but then there's just so much stuff.
Yeah.
And you can tell that it's not what the filmmaker wants to actually be doing.
Right.
It feels arduous. It feels like work. And then all of a sudden, the piranhas start attacking people.
That's when it turns on.
That's when it turns on.
You know, I'm glad you bring this up because when we were talking about Aliens during our Alien 3 episode, James Cameron film, in my opinion, possibly his best movie. This is just my opinion.
Aliens.
I don't know. Aliens, maybe. Maybe between that and The Abyss. Mm-hmm. I don't know. At least in terms of movies that James Cameron has done that have aged okay. There are times that when I watch a James Cameron movie, I can't escape the feeling that he kind of hates the first half of his own movie.
That's a good way to put it.
Journey for him that he's just like, okay, here's all this crap that I have to do just to make you care about the stuff that I care about, you know? I'm not saying that he didn't care about Jack and Rose on the Titanic, you know? But the way it's written and the way the story is told, it just feels like it's just like this mechanical steps that he's making us take to be like, okay, does everybody care about these two idiots yet? Do you care? You care? You care? Okay, we all care. Great, we all care.
So let's get into what we
want to
do.
Now let's get into the real James Cameron stuff that I really wanted to do, you know? And I realize that's very cynical, but I think you're right. There's that splitting in half that, yeah, he cares about the second half.
He does. And I think the reason you can tell that he cares about the second half, there seems to be a moment in James Cameron movies where there's like a reveal. It's this turn of like, okay, this is now what the movie's going to be. In Aliens, when you discover, oh, there's a whole shitload of aliens.
Right.
Right? In T2, Arnold Schwarzenegger, his character, isn't the bad guy.
Right.
They're in The Abyss, oh, there's this, I don't even know what you would call this alien thing.
Right.
There's this introduction of this element into the movie. You're like, wait a second, why didn't this happen sooner? Mm-hmm. I mean, right, that's the thing about a James Cameron movie, is it's like, why do all that work to get to that moment where you're just like, oh, okay, this is what you want to do.
I think he's worried that we won't care about the stuff he cares about until we have that experience, though. I remember we were talking like the Oscar special that we did like a year ago, and we were talking about, for example, Hell or High Water, which is a movie I still love.
Right.
We were talking about how impressive it was that it brought us into the story that was already in progress.
Yeah.
Rather than making us do the work of setting up the story and just, oh, okay, well, you know, here's the part where they meet and here's the part where they decide what the plan is and here's the part where they get all their equipment together to go rob a bank. No, the story opens with the robbery of the bank. You fill in the rest for yourself just fine because it's a very tightly written thing. I don't know that James Cameron knows how to do that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know how to slam you into the stuff that's important to James Cameron. I think if he learned that skill, I mean, I don't want to say he'd be more successful, because who's more successful than James Cameron, but I think his movies might actually have more staying power.
I mean, I think it begs the question about character development. You're developing characters for the purpose of, are those real characters?
Yeah.
That's one of the beautiful things, at least thinking about James Cameron and thinking about at least Alien and Aliens. And the difference there is that you discover who characters are in the midst of like this growing tension, right? In Alien, kind of the uncertainty of what's going on. In Aliens, I'm going to develop characters for the purpose of something else.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you do that well. I mean, that's a question that comes to mind. It's like, yeah, how does that work? I don't know.
Yeah. For some reason, James Cameron movies age like avocados. It's true.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true. When you first see a James Cameron movie, you are pretty legitimately bowled over.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's the most expensive thing you'll have ever seen. And that's consistent throughout most of his career.
Oh, man. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's the big news story every single time a James Cameron movie comes out. It's the, well, he's done it again. He's broken every record. He's spent more on this movie than has ever been spent on a movie. I mean, you know, T2, True Lies, Titanic, Avatar. Every single one of these movies was, at that moment, the most had ever been spent on a movie. Even the mainstream public is just kind of aware of that.
Yeah, it's a thing.
And everyone's intrigued by it. Just like, oh, well, yeah, I want to see the most expensive movie of all time. You know, even though you know that it's, you know, whatever. I'm making it sound like everyone secretly hates James Cameron. I know they don't. I've said it in the past. I'm not a James Cameron guy. He's just not a director that does it for me. But you'll notice consistently with James Cameron movies, you know, it seems like almost by the time they hit the video rack, they're looked at as these things that's just like, oh, remember how silly we were when we liked this ridiculous movie and this, you know, it's immediately torn apart.
Yeah.
But I'll admit it, you know, Avatar came out. And I thought, it's a James Cameron movie. I know I'm not going to be into it.
Mm-hmm.
I have to see this expensive movie, though. I have to see it. And sure enough, even when it came out on video, I'm just like, ugh, remember how much I didn't like Avatar? You know what, though? Maybe I should get it on DVD just so that I could pick through it, because it's clearly very expensive.
And you did.
I didn't. No, I was able to resist with Avatar. I was still sucked in by Titanic, which I still have on VHS.
Well, of course. Why wouldn't you have that on VHS? Mm. No, but there's something about that. I think that he creates cultural moments, right, that you want to be a part of. Somehow, his films take up so much of the space of conversation about filmmaking.
Sure.
In terms of cost. And this is something that he should be credited for, is in terms of technology. I mean, he is an innovator, right? That is something that he has done throughout his career.
Yeah.
No one will tell him that he can't get the shot he wants, because then he will figure out and he will spend the money and he will find the people to get him the thing that he wants.
Including developing a whole new technology that didn't even exist before just to get a shot.
I mean, that's incredible.
It's amazing.
I mean, you have to give the guy credit for that.
Sure.
All of that is kind of connected to what he's doing.
Yeah.
But story isn't. I mean, that's the thing that I think is really interesting about James Cameron. Story isn't essential. It's what you see. It's the story behind how you see what you see. That's the thing that James Cameron gives us.
Yeah. Is the world a better place because of James Cameron? I mean, I think a lot of ways, sure, of course. There's so many films that owe so much to James Cameron by virtue of the discoveries that he's made. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I mean, even in the past several years, I remember seeing a commentary track. I think it was on a David Fincher movie, maybe even. You had two characters that were cold and they were talking outside. And, you know, you hear Fincher talking on the commentary track about there was some breath left over from Titanic that we were able to use. And there's just these things that James Cameron has just made gets to use now because he decided that it needed to get made. Yeah, Avatar was, you know, whatever. Basically, it was a $300 million fern gully, and whatever. That's the deal.
But it's an expensive fern gully.
It's the most expensive fern gully you'll ever see.
It's true.
But the fact of the matter is there was technology developed for that film that was crucial to films that came after it in terms of, you know, ability with effects. you know, Titanic, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, just nothing like that had ever even been conceived in terms of like a way to do a movie right. like that. The blending of real footage of the actual Titanic with, you know, and with CG transitions into, I mean, you know, you just didn't do that.
No.
And he figured out how to do it. The Abyss, to this day, there is deep sea diving equipment yep. that was developed for that movie
yes.
just so he could shoot this movie in a specific kind of a way that is even still to this day used by deep sea divers and scientists and things like that in order to make the discoveries that they're making. So you're right. It's incredible. It's incredible what he's doing. And yeah, I guess it is kind of shitty to complain that, you know, these are attached to movies with bad scripts. But, well, you know what? Let's talk about that.
It's not shitty.
Well, let's talk about that, though, because I feel like my complaint with James Cameron in general is at the script level.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that this whole discussion, I'm being very, very assuming, you know. It sounds like you're more on the fence about James Cameron than maybe I am.
I don't know if I'm more on the fence about James Cameron. I think that he's an interesting figure in filmmaking, given the boundaries that he attempts to push as a filmmaker to make things happen. I think that's his innovation to me is remarkable because that's not my brain, right?
Yeah.
Like we talked about this with Christopher Nolan. I think we can even connect it back to Gilliam. Both of those directors work, I think, really well within constraints, right? Like they actually look at their kind of their environments and what they're attempting to do and say, okay, this is what I want, but here's what I have. How can I work within this? And I think they end up making something better for it.
Yeah.
James Cameron, he is arrogant, and you can read a lot of different interviews with people. He's a dick. I think that connects to his kind of hubris and saying, oh no, I'm not going to work within constraints. I'm actually going to figure out and spend the money and do what I need to do to get what I want.
So that I don't have any.
Right, exactly. And I don't think that his films are better for it, but I think that other artists and filmmakers then take what he's done
right.
and use it kind of in better ways.
I think you're right. And I think that's a great point. And it's something that I forget a lot with James Cameron because there's no James Cameron movie that I can look at and say, yeah, but that one I actually was really into. They're all the same kind of recipe that we all know, you know? I mean, and that's why I was sort of like, holy cow, this was even true back in Piranha. He has these obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back to the same well over and over. Every character he writes is a stock character. There's very little, if any, depth to any character. He comes up with the motivation that he needs as part of a story, and he puts a body around that.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely need someone who, you know, we were even talking about on the Aliens episode. We need a sassy Latina on the team. We need a straight arrow button pusher right. for this part. We need a wild card over here.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, it's all totally stock. And you never really, at least I don't, ever really care about these characters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying no one does, but I don't.
Right.
There's other things too, though, that are really specific affectations for him, like underwater,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yes. I mean, he has a documentary about that.
Yeah. He loves to shoot underwater. In fact, the guy who's actually my DP, his name's Doug. We were talking about this earlier this week. I asked him because I've never done this.
Mm-hmm.
I've never shot anything that takes place underwater. And I was asking him if he ever had. He was like, you know what? There's nothing worse
wow.
than that. It's such a lousy way to shoot a movie.
Really?
It's uncomfortable. Mm. It's claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly worried about the equipment, that everything's going to get damaged and stuff. And by the way, supposedly there's a story from the set where he lost a very expensive camera on the set of Piranha 2.
Yeah. Wow.
Due to some accident that happened. And it's constant paranoia. Your cast and your crew have trouble, you know, they've got to breathe through these things and everybody's worried about, you know, what if they're trying to concentrate on character, but at the same time, everybody's underwater. And it's just, it's misery. But James Cameron loves it. He loves things that are underwater. Another thing, again, all the way back in Piranha 2, James Cameron loves this as a story point. The military
comes
in,
yes,
and in their hubris, fucks everything
up.
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
You know, almost every movie. The only movie where I can think that where there's that's nowhere in the movie is Titanic. Every other movie mm-hmm. that I can think of, it's this James Cameron movie, there's some sort of military force wanting to save the day, but actually ends up making something worse.
Right, for sure. I think that's true. Unless maybe the fiddle players at the end of Titanic are somehow government spies that are...
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah. But you have all these things. Stock characters, footage underwater, the military coming in and screwing everything over for everybody. You know, whatever.
Yeah, it's all there.
So that's when I read things like, oh, James Cameron doesn't really consider Piranha 2 a real James Cameron movie. I'm like, bullshit, it isn't.
There's
I see
so many
all
things.
That
yeah.
stuff in that movie.
I think you're right. And this is a bold claim and a really cynical claim, so I'm aware of it. I don't know if he's that interested in individuals.
Yeah.
In terms of people being people, like it seems like he looks at a movie or he looks at an idea and he says, what can I do? Instead of saying like, whose stories am I telling?
Yeah.
Which I think that's a really important distinction between filmmakers that I actually really appreciate and filmmakers that I can tell when they're using the medium and they're using characters and they're using a story to do what they already want to do.
Yeah.
And I can see that in James Cameron's films. Yeah. Like it's just like you said earlier, I need to sprinkle some of this in to warrant my doing this. It's like, oh yeah, that's one of the reasons why I don't think I connect with James Cameron's movies, because I'm like, I just don't think you're interested in people.
Yeah, he's more interested in moving big objects around, even if those objects are metaphorical, if they're story objects or, you know, creature objects. Or I think you might be onto something. So here's something I was trying to figure out. What is it about James Cameron? I mean, we know about the big budgets, and that's got to be part of it. Beyond that, though, what is it about James Cameron movies that are such dynamite when they come out? And later on, in hindsight, they're so stale. I was not part of the Terminator wave. I didn't see Terminator until long after the fact.
The first one?
Either of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, my whole life I had heard, Terminator is just one of the best ever. Went back, watched both of them back to back. And I think it may have even been like the director's cut of one of them or both of them or something. I was like, all right, you know, show me the true vision of what James Cameron was trying to do with these Terminator movies that apparently everyone in the universe loves. I was dumbstruck by how bad they were. I mean, I'm sorry, and I realize that I'm like offending a lot of audience people.
Oh, yeah, you're stepping on so many people.
Because people love these movies.
Love them.
It's so hard for me to understand beyond nostalgia what people liked about these movies. I didn't see one thing that I liked about any of them. Either of them, I should say, because he only did two. I mean, just the writing, the performances, just the hacky setup, obviously the effects have aged poorly, but you know, whatever, that's understandable. I straight up didn't get it, you know, and I was looking at it and thinking, I mean, yeah, maybe when I was 7 years old, if I had seen this, maybe it would have been a really cool thing. All these people that are talking about how much they love like Terminator, for example, or True Lies or something. When's the last time you actually saw this movie? Because I got to tell you, I don't think it's what you remember.
Yeah, so I think this is a fun conversation because I can go there. Like I watched Terminator 2, I think at least twice in the theater because my dad loved Terminator. I saw it when I shouldn't have. And as a 10-year-old and even younger seeing Terminator, taps into something that I think is really interesting. Well, there are a few elements that I'm talking about. It's really fun. Like you have the future, you have artificial intelligence with robots, and you have this like apocalyptic kind of future potential or setting.
Right.
All of that kind of captured my imagination in terms of like, what if? The thing about James Cameron is he's always connected to something that is above the actual film that he's making.
Yeah.
So with Terminator, I'd say it was that. It was like all those different things. And then the technology, you have the T-1000 and the liquid metal that could reform beautiful.
Come with me if you want to live.
With Titanic, you have like the tapping into this historical thing that you've heard about. How can this massive ship be overcome by an iceberg? I mean, it's a metaphor, right? That's kind of, it taps into that. And then you have this love story. And I guess with the abyss, it would be the ocean,
right,
and kind of the mystery that that is. With Avatar, I can't really detach it from the 3D aspect to it.
Sure.
So it just seems like he's always connecting to these little, like these other pieces beyond the film.
Yeah.
That kind of hooks audiences.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. There's always some sort of hook. James Cameron isn't shy about taking us behind the scenes of his movies. He wants people to see the lengths that he went. I mean, I remember seeing news stories on TV. Well, look, if you look underneath the dishes on the Titanic, you can see it says RMS Titanic underneath. This is the kind of detail that James Cameron likes. And I remember people were just like, wow, yeah, that means the movie's good.
So, you know? So behind the scenes documentaries, he's like, yes.
I think he likes that. He likes these stories from the set and things like that getting out, because that goes to show the insane lengths that he goes for these movies. I mean, you know, I look at that now, like stories like that, and I'm just like, are you freaking insane to like spend money on making sure that this thing is underneath a plate that no one and that the camera's never going to see? You spent budget on that?
Yeah.
I mean, holy cow, why? That's the completely cynical side of me. I mean, you know, and you could say like, well, okay, it's something that helps the actors get into a certain kind of vibe and character and all that. And that's fine. But then I go back to, well, if you're so all fired, excited about getting your actors to get all methody, that doesn't seem to be evidenced in the script.
No, for know? Sure.
Because the script is so just like kind of stale and hacked out and boardroomy almost, you know? And again, I realize I'm probably stepping on so many toes here. It's just, by the way, he writes everything that he directs. I've never seen a James Cameron movie that I was just like, well, actually, that script was pretty good. They're all terrible.
Yeah.
All of them.
Oh, and starting with Piranha 2. I mean, I think that...
By the way, and I don't mean to interrupt you, is that when I say something like that, like all of his scripts are terrible, is that...
Do I agree with that?
Well, yeah, or do I guess I connect for with one, does that seem like an overstatement? Because that's my impression, and I know a lot of people would disagree with that.
Well, no, I mean, I think we keep coming back to this, but I just don't think people matter to James Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people in his films matter, characters. I don't think his actors matter. I mean, yeah. I heard a story behind the scenes of The Abyss where he told them, you know, we need to save time. Just relieve yourselves in your wetsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard of stories where if a phone goes off or something on set that he carries a nail gun with him and will nail them to the wall and stuff like that. Like, I can see you doing that, Jeremy, but
yeah, sure. I nail cell phones.
I think that you're right in the sense that when he's writing a movie, he's not thinking about the people.
Yeah. Do you think he's a decent writer?
I think he makes things I enjoy looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I think to be a good script writer, you have to be able to make people care about the people that the stories are about. And I typically don't. No, I don't think anybody goes to a James Cameron movie to see people they care about.
Yeah. I think people went to Titanic for that.
Really?
Kind of. I mean, I remember...
Because of Jack and...
I remember people like getting misty over the Jack and Rose story. I remember that being like a thing. People were just like, oh my gosh. And you know, and he was drawing her and you could see her left boob, and it was such a beautiful
and the
moment.
Steamy car.
Yeah, they fogged up the car. I mean, I was I thought it was very intense when people were falling to their death off the Titanic, because especially when you think that, oh wow, this is probably has some credibility in terms of like the realism of it.
Right.
I appreciated that. Leonardo DiCaprio screaming that he's the king of the world and all that, I don't care. And speaking of which, oh my gosh, one of those cringeworthy Oscar moments of all time is, you know, when James Cameron decided to reproduce that moment for the Oscars audience.
There's no way that I can express to you what I'm feeling right now. My heart is full to bursting, except to say, I'm the king of the world!
I think you're onto something when you say people are props to James
Cameron.
That's
a good, yeah, I didn't say that way, but that's a good way of saying it.
I don't know. And I realize that I'm farther on the not a James Cameron guy spectrum than most people. I think most people are in closer to how you described. Mm-hmm. You go to a James Cameron movie for certain things, and I think there's exceptions, but you don't go to learn more about the human condition.
Oh no, I think that's absolutely true.
You go to be dazzled. As the story goes on the set of Piranha 2, James Cameron went to bed one night and, you know, he got sick or food poisoning or something like that. And he had a dream about a metal skeleton clawing his way across the floor with knives. And that's how he thought of Terminator was on, you know, was during the production of Piranha 2. You know, James Cameron didn't have a dream about a woman's relationship with her son who may end up being the person who's very significant to, you know, the way we live our lives in the future. No.
No.
It was a chopped in half metal skeleton clawing its way across the floor.
Right.
That would look really freaking cool.
That's exactly James Cameron. And it's got to be his thought. I think of The Abyss, I think of Terminator 2, I think of Avatar. The things in those films that he's trying to elicit most emotion from are non-human.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting thing. I mean, you have like the alien thing in The Abyss, you start to feel for that. Artificial intelligence or robot, you're starting to feel for him. You kind of forget about other characters. Mm. That to me is like a really interesting connection. Piranha 2 doesn't have that, right. In which you don't care about anything. Like, you right. don't care about the characters there. You don't care about the flying killers. Yeah, I mean, as I think about his movies, I'm like, I don't know if I care about any person
right.
in any of them, really.
Well, I think there's a moment in Piranha 2, Lance Henriksen, he's trying to figure out, he's up in his helicopter, and he's trying to figure out, there's a bomb that's about to go off under the water. He's worried that his wife is down there with her lover. Anyway, whatever. It's a great film.
The government.
Yeah, the government lover. And he's trying to figure out if she was able to swim to safety in time before this bomb goes up to blow up all these flying piranha. Mm-hmm. As you do.
Yeah.
He makes the decision. He jumps out of the helicopter. The helicopter then careens down toward the water and explodes on contact for some reason. It's just, it's a ball of flames.
That's what happens.
That's what happens when any helicopter touches the water, it explodes immediately. It's so ludicrous and unnecessary and gratuitous. To me, it's the picture of James Cameron's approach in general. Mm. And I'm not even saying this is James Cameron's idea.
That.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like something needs to blow up. And even if I've got to like strain credibility,
this is the time.
Yeah. It's been way too long since something's blown up. To me, that's like James Cameron in a nutshell. Even as I'm saying all this, I realize that my opinion of James Cameron is coming across like it's my opinion of Kevin Smith or something. And that's not really the case.
So you don't compare those or no, you don't
not
connect
really
those.
Because here's the thing. When the next Kevin Smith movie comes out, I'm not going to go.
Oh, right.
When the next James Cameron movie comes out, I'm going to hate myself for going, but I'm going to go.
Right.
You know I'm going to go because I'm interested to see what new thing is happening in film. And I know by now that James Cameron is going to show us the next thing that's going to be happening in film, even though I know I'm going to have to sit through a story that's going to get me real annoyed.
So here's my question about, and maybe it's a question about James Cameron films at large, but it's specifically a question in relation to Piranha 2, is there a place for movies like Piranha 2 in cinema?
You know, I bought Piranha 2 in order to watch it as many times as I need to watch it in preparation for this.
Right.
So I'm the owner of Piranha 2.
You own it, yeah.
On digital video. And, you know, because they give you the things. Well, since you bought this, you're probably also interested in bop, bop, bop. You see the little carousel at the bottom of all the things that you probably like if you like this movie enough to buy it. But a lot of these movies were these, I don't know, Troll 2, like so bad it's good kind of movies. Oh,
right.
You know?
Which you don't do well with.
No, I don't like that stuff. But I know that there's a type of person who is into that kind of stuff, that they love to enjoy movies ironically. And at the end of the day, I do think there's a place for Piranha 2. Yeah, of course, you're going to have the ironic enjoyers and all that. Honestly, I think it's kind of helpful as a person who creates to see this. I think it's more helpful to see good films,
mm-hmm.
but I think there is a value in seeing something like this and saying, well, let's really try and figure out what this movie is doing wrong, though.
Right.
Because it's doing a lot wrong. What mistakes is this film making that filmmakers should be aware of?
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think it's almost kind of a study in things that are easy to do, things that are easy to let your movie become.
Mm-hmm.
But look, this is what happens when you don't give a damn about doing a good job with your ADR. This is what happens when you spend too much plot time. And this is like, this is true. The movie's an hour and a half long. It begins with a piranha attack. The next time a piranha is even mentioned,
oh man,
is about like what, it's like another half hour.
Oh, so at least,
like a third of the way of the movie, because it's just all this expositional bullcrap. You can see things like that. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that's interesting. You know, we had to get through over 35% mm-hmm. of our movie before we even started to get to any kind of semblance of a point. That's really helpful. Does any of that make the film worth seeing? Not in my opinion, but there are things to be learned. I don't know that I can get much more than that, though.
Kind of remind me of something I read Robert Altman saying, actually, as he was describing how, yeah, he learned a lot of things from watching the films he loved, but he learned more things from watching the films that he couldn't stand.
It's interesting. What do you think? What is there a place for Piranha 2?
So is the premise of flying piranhas attacking people in and of itself a bad idea?
That's a good question. Can you make a good movie out of
that? Right, can you make a good movie out of that? And what would it take to do so? I don't know the answer to that, but the question was really fascinating to me, thinking like, could Quentin Tarantino
make a good flying piranha movie?
Make a good flying piranha movie. I don't know. I mean, genre-wise, maybe.
Yeah.
So is there a place for those sorts of films? I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that. That's kind of the reason why I was asking the question. Certainly, I'd like to think cinema is an art form that would be inclusive of many different expressions of how someone might want to engage a person's imagination or audience. And I would be intrigued to see somebody say, you know what, I'm going to give this a shot. And not simply to be able to show naked women or gore, but can I tell a good story and have conflict in which the center of that conflict is a flying piranha? Uh-huh. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm intrigued by it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, again, we've had a couple of these. Fear and Desire is definitely one. We've had a couple of, yeah, this is definitely a completist situation. The only case where you should watch this movie is if you want to be able to say, I've seen every James Cameron movie. Other than that, no, you don't need to bother seeing it. We're probably agreed on that, right?
Bro, yeah, for sure. I don't give your time to this.
Don't give your time to this. In fact, I would say even if you are a James Cameron completist, even still, really think this one over, right? Because there are better things you could do with your time.
Consider your options.
Yeah, but as a side-by-side with seeing the underwater footage he was able to get with this movie next to what he was able to get with like Titanic or something.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's like, oh, wow. It just, even the art of shooting things underwater in a really specific way, he developed that skill and that art form. And, you know, again, it's just the film industry in general has reaped the benefits of it.
He's obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I'm so intrigued by that.
I'll tell you, I think there's a part of me that wishes that I had more appreciation for James Cameron.
James Cameron wishes you had that too. The guy is so interested in having the conversation about his knowledge versus other people's knowledge. I mean, right, he called out recently Wonder Woman as it being a step backward in terms of like action films, and I think with female characters as front and center.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he was hating on Wonder Woman. I heard him say like, oh, you know, I can watch a blockbuster film and I can see the problems with it. If only I had like 25 minutes with the director before he made the movie, then maybe this wouldn't have happened. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. There's something there about.
Yeah, I heard he almost snapped up the rights to Jurassic Park before Steven Spielberg.
Oh, I read that too. It's so fascinating.
Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, he was talking about like, yeah, Spielberg used kid gloves with Jurassic Park. And I'm like, I don't think you're going to make a better Jurassic Park than Spielberg, but I don't know, man. At the end of the day, even though that, you know, he's got cast and crew of thousands and he's got these insane budgets and he's, you know, this cinematic legend, I think there's a side of it where he just sits there and thinks, you know, I bet This
oh,
would
yeah.
be so badass if I were able to... Oh.
That's what he's doing right now with Avatar.
Isn't he making like three of them at once right now or something like that?
I don't even know, man.
It's a lot of Avatars.
It's like the spawning
yeah.
of Dances with Wolves and Fern Gully.
Well, so here's the question then. With James Cameron, where do you put Piranha 2, The Spawning, and all these James Cameron movies?
Oh, my word.
I mean, it's. I guess it kind of answers itself.
It does answer itself.
Honestly, and this is a sincere answer, yes, it's his worst movie. I mean,
right,
you know, far
is.
And away, clearly. But for me, I don't know that there's as much distance between Piranha 2 as maybe we would all of us would like to think. And I don't say that to just be like because James Cameron sucks. I'm not trying to say that, because clearly he's a talented filmmaker. He really genuinely is. I mean, yeah, it's a bad movie and I'm not a James Cameron guy, but I'll allow that he is capable of amazing things.
That's kind.
That's where it's, he is. I mean, I think you would have to be a fool to not,
well, yeah,
to not admit that, yes, he is capable of some pretty astonishing feats.
So what's at the top for you then? And now you don't have to give me an order. I think that would be hard, but what's at the top?
I'm not saying it's his best movie, but the one I have the most affection for probably is Aliens.
It is.
Probably.
Okay.
And I hate the setup of that movie, but he gave us a really, really exciting third act.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, you know, like I said, it's not where I would have taken the Ellen Ripley story, but it's not Alien, and it's not Alien 3, and it's not Prometheus, and it's not all these others. It's its own thing, and I don't like it as much as maybe the other Alien movies, but there are some really cool moments in there that I think I'd be remiss to not admit that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite?
You know, yeah, I have a favorite, and simply because of, and I do think it's nostalgia. Like, I wouldn't say it's probably his best, but Terminator 2 is one of those movies where, when I remember going to movies, that's certainly one of those films that was up there and watching and being amazed by.
Yeah, it may be like the ultimate had to be their movie, because, and I wasn't, but I remember people at the time went bananas.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that, for me, is probably there.
Yeah. I don't know. Whatever you might say, you know, however dumb you might think some of these plot contrivances were, you know, in True Lies or whatever it is. I mean, I want to say, like, to this day, he was the first, and to this day, one of only like three people that have been to the bottom of the what is it called? The Mariana Trench, mm-hmm. Which is the lowest point you can get to in
right.
the world or something,
yeah.
I guess, under the water. And, you know, that's kind of cool, dude.
It
really
cool.
is.
It's
you
super
know?
Cool.
The fact that he's that kind of personality that wanted to do that, developed the technology, paid the money, figured it out, did that. That's pretty badass.
No, for sure. The guy's such an interesting dude. He's part of like this organization that's really wanting to spearhead civilization on Mars.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
yeah.
Such an interesting guy.
Interesting guy. Honestly, I find myself now thinking about James Cameron in ways that I didn't really expect to.
Like more positively?
Kind of. I guess. I don't know that I can come all the way around to thinking that he's the maker of films that I love. But
for sure.
I think maybe he's actually a really important guy who's done some really important things.
Well, here's the thing. I thought I was going to come in here and shit on Piranha 2.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, and trust me, I have the notes that I could use to shit on Piranha 2. Sure. But I really appreciated where our conversation went and saying, okay, well, yeah, all those things are probably true.
Yeah.
What else is there that we might be able to talk about?
You know, there's a lot of people who are maybe not necessarily rabid James Cameron fans, but as we mentioned earlier, there's nostalgia for a lot of these films. And yeah, okay, maybe some of the things that we were talking about having specifically to do with James Cameron and his films, maybe they rubbed you the wrong way. I want to know what it is that you love about a specific James Cameron film, what it is I'm missing, what you think it is that's missing from this discussion. If you've got thoughts on that, hey, listen, I want to hear it. Daniel wants to hear it. Tell us what's on your mind. James Cameron, the matter at hand, let us know.
And we really do want to hear from you. And you can look us up on Facebook or on Instagram. You can email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. We honestly would love to hear your thoughts, your opinions, suggestions for episodes. So don't be shy. Reach out.
And speaking of which, if you'd like to give us a review or a rating on iTunes, hugely helpful. Helps with our search results for people that are searching for a podcast, especially if it's about films or the kind of stuff that we like talking about here. So, and by the way, for those who have given us reviews and ratings, super duper thank you. Really, really appreciate it.
And you know what, Jeremy? If people were wanting to watch Piranha 2, The Spawning, you know where they shouldn't look?
Well, I can tell you that one place that they should not look is probably the streaming service that you and I both enjoy. And of course, that is Filmstruck.
Filmstruck.
A lot of the Turner Classic Movies and also Criterion Collection films. Films that you, without paying a lot of money, don't have a way to get access to any other way. It's such a great service, not just the films themselves, not just great directors and curated collections that they have there, but also extras and interviews and all kinds of things that you can't find anywhere else. I love Filmstruck. Daniel loves it.
Love it.
You're not going to go wrong with a subscription to Filmstruck. Well, once again, I think that's it for this episode. Thanks so much for joining us. As always, I'm Jeremy Bear.
And I'm Daniel Long.
We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening. Skitter, no, I said, get out and buy. Skitter, no, I said,